From KUBR News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The new documentary film, The Great Hack, is about data. Data being the information we've been feeding these big tech companies, our likes and our interactions and our behavior. And companies sell this data. As someone explains in the film, any buyer has direct access to a person's emotional pulse, so they can feed back to you this steady stream of content that they've catered just for you, what you like, what you fear, and what gets your attention. Today in the program, we're talking about The Great Hack. It's part of our film series. The filmmakers will join us to talk about how companies, one in particular, use this information to create dissension and conflict in politics. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You ever have this feeling that your phone is listening to your conversation somehow? Or your smart device? That Alexa or whatever heard you talking about needing a new hose in the backyard, and then all of a sudden this ad for gardening products appears in your Instagram feed? Well, experts say it can work that way, that your devices do hear trigger words, but in many cases, the reason we're getting targeted promotions for sneakers and water filters, and the reason we're seeing political campaign ads in our feeds, is that these companies just know us so well. Because for years, we've been feeding them data in our searches and likes and clicks. You know, where we shop, our route to work, our resting heart rate. Karim Amer and Jahan Nujaim's new documentary film is about data, how valuable it's become. In the film, someone points out data is now the world's most valuable commodity. It's worth more than oil. Their film is called The Great Hack, and it's about how companies are taking this data we're feeding them and they're manipulating us. They're appealing to the worst parts of our nature, our fears and our hate. They focus the film on the story of the rise and fall of one company, the data firm Cambridge Analytica, which, without their consent, mined the data of millions of people from their Facebook profiles. And they used it to create these political ads for the Trump campaign. The film is called The Great Hack. It's the latest in our documentary film series with the Utah Film Center. And on Wednesday, we're going to be screening the film. Today in the program, we're talking with the filmmakers. Jahan Nujaim and Karim Amer co-directed the film, which premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. They also collaborated on the documentary The Square, which was nominated for an Oscar in 2014. Nujaim and Amer joined us from a studio in New York City, and we began by talking about data itself, which in the abstract is easy enough to talk about, but how do you show data in a film?
Data has been the most interesting and complicated word in making this film. On the one hand, as we've seen in the process of making this, the value of data has grown exponentially. And so this idea of data being this extremely powerful and influential concept or reality, rather, commodity, rather, depending on the word you want to use, mm-hmm. Has been something that we have been tracking and trying to use to tell the story. And we found that the way in which it became interesting was to try and find a way to visualize it. That was our biggest challenge with this story, is how do you tell a story about data, which is something that everybody has a basic understanding of, but is somewhat invisible to, in a compelling narrative, and how do you make it one in which people can see? And so that became kind of the challenge in making this movie. And it took us a lot of trial and error to figure out how to actually, how to do that.
How to portray it.
Because
we see in the film, and I like the way you've actually ended up, because we see these moments when we all reveal ourselves to the World Wide Web, you know, when we buy something by swiping a card, when we swipe a ticket in a subway turnstile, you know, in our texts, our fitness apps, you know, they tell us about our relationships, our resting heart rate, all of this stuff is revealed, and we see it graphically early on in the film That seems like a really important way of describing it. Like, it's pervasive. It's everywhere right now.
It's everywhere. And so we in the film, we try to kind of portray that in the opening sequence that you see with David Carroll, who is a professor at the New School and is kind of like an everyday man trying to figure this out. And I think that what we begin the film purposely the conversation of data in a non-political space to just show, before we get into the politicalization of data, just kind of the use of data on an everyday level and how we interact with it, and to create what we call this kind of data exhaust, to show how we're all kind of releasing these digital footprints of ourselves constantly in all of our interactions. I think it was important for us to show the range of that and the everyday nature of it, to show that this isn't something that you engage with once a week or once in a while or when you want to vote. Your data is something that you're constantly releasing, and that's why we created this visual language of this kind of data exhaust. And from there, we take the audience onto a journey where you start to see, well, not only are we releasing this data, and not only is there so much of it out there, but it's become a part of an incredibly powerful and potent industry.
Yeah.
And it's being traded and sold constantly. And some people, a lot of people know that already. But I think what a lot of people haven't connected in our experience is understanding how that actually affects their life. I mean, just today I was at the bank and talking to, the clerk there and telling him about the film. And he's like, "This sounds amazing, but, I don't use Facebook anymore. And I don't really see how this affects me. I'm not doing anything political." And I said, "This has, data's kind of the effects of data on your life have nothing to do with whether you're politicized or not." Yeah. The reality is that we live in a world now whereby we get services in exchange for giving up our data. That is one of the main kind of exchanges that fuels so much of the Silicon Valley economy, where consumers give up data and they get services in return. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, in that barter exchange, when you have companies like Facebook and Google, who most of us use but never have actually paid any money directly to, yet somehow these companies are worth so much money, where is the money being made and how? And I think that's when the kind of data conversation and question becomes quite interesting.
Let me play a moment from the film. You mentioned David Carroll. We'll talk about him in just a moment. But he talks about this point you make, that it's pervasive, that data really is, these companies are getting a sense of what he calls our emotional pulse. And then he lays out this really important theme in the film, this idea that it all began as this noble enterprise, and then it really kind of devolved into something else. Let me play this moment so we can talk about it. Here's David Carroll from the film.
"It began with the dream of a connected world. A space where everyone could share each other's experiences and feel less alone. It wasn't long before this world became our matchmaker, instant fact checker, personal entertainer, guardian of our memories, even our therapist. I was teaching digital media and developing apps, so I knew that the data from our online activity wasn't just evaporating. And as I dug deeper, I realized these digital traces of ourselves are being mined into a $1 trillion-a-year industry. We are now the commodity. But we were so in love with the gift of this free connectivity that no one bothered to read the terms and conditions."
One of David Carroll's students tells him in the film that, since she grew up with the internet as this reality, that the ads frankly don't really bother her all that much. And it did make me wonder, and this is something I think, Karim, you were mentioning, if we're willing to make these trade-offs. Like, that seems like an important theme in the film, you know, trading privacy and intellectual autonomy for convenience and connectivity. Do you think that's an important part of this?
I think it's a very important question. What are we willing to trade for easy connectivity, free connectivity? What she asks, I think, is the question that is on a lot of our minds, which is that it doesn't seem to be so much of a problem when you are being advertised maybe more accurately. So if your newsfeed is being, if what you post is being watched, if what you say is being listened to, and you know, you're being the right washing machine is being advertised to you, that doesn't seem to be such a big deal. But when you start to look at the wreckage sites of where that has led to, in terms of people's news feeds then being particularly tailored and continually tailored in an ongoing way, as you post more, as you then watch a news feed that is specifically tailored to you, and you go deeper and deeper into your own rabbit hole. And I think that that's where the danger lies. And that's where we started to see with what was happening in the 2016 election and with Brexit and with the hostility that's existing between groups as people go down their own rabbit holes, even in the same households.
David Carroll, he talks about being the annoying parent, the one who reads the terms and conditions and to the apps that his kids are signing up with, and he has these conversations with them. Talk a little bit about what he's looking for, what he wants, what's driving him in the film.
Well, I think David Carroll was somebody that Kareem and I were drawn to, actually, because in the making of this film, we had three kids. We cheated a little because two of those kids are twins. But as we were having children, we were thinking about the future for our kids and what world they were going to grow up in.
Yeah.
And I think we were attracted to David because he was thinking along those same lines and very concerned about the world that his daughter is growing up in and how all of these data points were being collected on her and how she would be manipulated and whether she would. It gets down to the biggest question, one of the biggest questions that we're faced with, which is, do we have free will when everything that we are looking at is being manipulated to satisfy us and to have us click more and, you know, basically to satisfy what we actually want to be reading rather than what annoys us or, you know, what makes us turn the page and which allows for the gray to exist in the world. And I think that those issues really concerned him. The future of our democracy concerned him. And so he's a professor at the New School. He was developing his own app and realized very quickly that he could see way more data and information on people that he ever imagined. And so I think this is what motivated him to look deeper and then to basically ask this very basic question of what are they doing with our data and where is it going and how is this all working? And so the other reason we were attracted to him as a character and somebody that we wanted to spend time with was we were trying to find a character that could take us into this world and we could follow his journey. So you actually had a human being that could take us deep into this world. And David was one of them because he was saying, I want my data back and I'm going to ask Cambridge Analytica for my data back. And we could follow this journey that he went on in order to get his data back and ultimately to sue Cambridge Analytica when they did not give him his data back.
Yeah. Cambridge Analytica, of course, is the now, I guess, infamous British political consulting company used data mining. The company closed last year after it was revealed they had mined the personal data of, you know, millions of people on Facebook without their consent. And David Carroll talks about in the film how these organizations build this, as he as he explains it, and as you were both talking about, the steady stream of content catered to one individual, based on what I like and based on what I fear and based on what gets my attention. I want to play another moment from the film, because one of the things that the former head of Cambridge Analytica talks about, Alexander Nix, is that personality drives behavior.
It's my privilege to speak to you today about the power of big data and psychographics.
When Cambridge Analytica joined the Trump campaign, we were an attractive proposition. We'd just spent 14 months working on the Ted Cruz campaign and had collected a huge amount of voter data and research, which we were able to hand over to the Trump team.
By having hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Americans undertake this survey, we were able to form a model where we have somewhere close to 4,000 or 5,000 data points we can use to predict the personality of every adult in the United States. Because it's personality that drives behavior, and behavior that obviously influences how you vote.
We could then start to target people with highly targeted digital video content.
Secretary Clinton said there was nothing marked classified on her emails, either sent or received. Was that true?
That's not true, Secretary.
Our movement is about replacing a failed and corrupt political establishment.
Why aren't I 50 points ahead, you might ask?
Do you really need to ask?
So we start to see this litany of these messages that are being sent to people. Talk a little bit about the content that's being sent. This is fear and conspiracy theories and exaggerated ideas and culture war stuff. I mean, what's the stuff they're targeting people with?
I think that what David Carroll and many felt and saw was that there was something different about the way information was being created, generated, and released. And I know that, you know, I'm sure that there's been an exhausting amount of conversation on the word fake news, but what we're talking about here is slightly different. It's not about fake news. It's about customized reality that is being fed to you constantly by your algorithms, whether it's through Facebook, Google, or others. And I think the question becomes that we have to ask ourselves is we're starting to see what we call these wreckage sites of places where people's digital behavior is breaking into the physical world and causing real life effects. Is what are we incentivizing? What have we designed these algorithms? What have we engineered them to do? Have we created them to kind of just, you know, to drive us crazy? Have we created them to kind of incentivize us to continue to return back to the newsfeed? And if so, what are the things that drive people? And if it's fear, have we created a mechanism whereby we're promoting a polarized reality where increasingly the thing that gets our attention is the thing that scares us? And if our feed can just be constantly dominated by that, then that's the reality that we see. I think that becomes a little worrisome, because what it seems to be creating is a place in which the more you're driven to the fringe, the more likely you're able to come back, the more scared you become. And that's a self-fulfilling prophecy that's very worrisome.
Karim Amer and Jahan Nujaim co-directed the documentary film The Great Hack, which we're going to be screening on Wednesday evening. That's July 10th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Nujaim and Amer are going to join us by Skype for a post-Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's mobile app gives you everything you love about our station on the go. Stream KUER live on your phone. Listen to NPR and local stories on demand. Then shift gears and listen to our 24/7 classical music station or explore podcasts like Radio West and 45 Days. It's all on the KUER app. Download it for free for Android or iOS, wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're carrying on with our film series, discussing a documentary that premiered at Sundance this year about data, which might sound boring at first, but of course it's not, because we're all giving these big tech companies our own data all the time, our preferences, our location, in some cases, the things we hate. The film is called The Great Hack. We're talking with the filmmakers Jahan Najim and Kareem Amer. I wanted to ask you about the style of the film for a moment, how you wanted to present it, because there's a lot of momentum. There's a lot of forward movement. Not that many actual just regular sit-down interviews. A lot of the way the story and the narrative plays out is kind of in these moments. And I wanted to just ask you about how you put that together, whether you conceived it that way or that's just the way it played out.
I come from a tradition of cinema verite filmmaking where the idea behind it is that you're really with people as they're discovering, as they're really jumping off the cliff, and you're making the commitment to jump off the cliff with them. But it also, what it does is it takes you into the rooms that you really want to be in as you're discovering the story. And so we did this with David, following him as he went on his quest to find his data and to sue Cambridge Analytica. And then we really wanted to find somebody inside Cambridge Analytica who was coming out. And that's where we found Brittany Kaiser. Yeah. Kareem found Brittany Kaiser, who was at the time kind of hiding or removing herself from the sort of public eye in Thailand. And she was about to go on this incredible journey where she was becoming a whistleblower, coming out. She had written the first contract for the Trump campaign. She was one of the top players at Cambridge Analytica. And she had come from a very different background. She had actually started her political career as an idealistic intern in the Obama administration. She had volunteered for Howard Dean. And she had taken, she had decided to work for Cambridge Analytica when they were doing some international work where she thought that some of the collection of data and understanding the effects of the use of that data and being able to quantify it and being able to see results was actually interesting to her before she became a part of a number of campaigns which actually didn't completely align with her political views.
Can I play this moment, actually?
Yes.
Because I think it's interesting. As you say, she's part of this group that they basically invented how social media is going to be used to communicate with voters. And she's doing it for, as you say, these progressive causes for Barack Obama. But then, as you said, she becomes kind of disillusioned. And I want to play this moment from the film where Brittany yes. Kaiser is talking about her early days, and that's fueled by idealism.
I then spent several years working on human rights and international relations, first for Amnesty International, then lobbying at the United Nations and European Parliament. And I used to always say I love human rights campaigning. But sometimes I feel like I'm banging my head against a brick wall because I can't see the results of what I'm doing. I don't know if I'm literally just wasting my time. And that's where I was when I met Alexander Nix.
And Alexander Nix, of course, this with Cambridge Analytica, this conservative figure, not at all in line with the way she used to be thinking. And this is going to jump out at people because she wasn't being able to see measurable results in the work that she was doing on the left of the spectrum. So she jumps over to the right to a very different cause altogether. And that's going to make people feel really conflicted about where Brittany Kaiser is coming from. Talk a little bit about such a complicated figure that she is, because she's a really interesting portrait in the film.
We love complicated characters. and Brittany was fascinating. And I love following people that surprise me. And who, because when you're following somebody that doesn't surprise you or make you laugh or take you places that you never imagined that you would go, you know, there isn't the magic to it. She brought magic to this story because she was quite unpredictable. And that was in her history and also in the decisions that she made as we were following her, which is what makes her such a compelling and fascinating character to follow. I do think that she is not somebody who, you know, some people love her and others just don't understand how she could completely go from one side to the other, which is explained in the movie. So you'll have to see the movie to understand why she actually made that switch. Mm-hmm. But she's somebody who, I mean, it's interesting. It's, you know, I think that we look at the fact that algorithms are kind of ruling our lives and ruling our decision making. And there's something of an amorality to the algorithm. Yeah. And so what does it mean in our lives that we now live, you know, with all these decisions being made, but are being made by a technology that doesn't actually have a moral compass. And we thought that there was kind of an interesting parallel with some of Brittany's journey, because at times it felt like she was saying, well, this is a job and this is fascinating and I'm at the cutting edge of data and technology and using that to change the world. And that's what's most interesting to me. And that's what's most important, is being on the cutting edge of that. And so I think she kind of put aside her feelings, her political feelings at times. And other times you'll see in the film, she says, well, this was really fascinating work for me, pitching the NRA, because this is the thinking of my grandparents and many members of my family. And I was forced to think, in order to pitch some of these groups, I was forced to stand in their shoes and to think about the decisions they would make. And in that way, brought me much closer to family members that I never thought I would be able to talk to. And we also think it's an really important person in the film, because we're in our silos and only listening to sort of the people that agree with us, having people in the film that come from such wildly different backgrounds and different political slants, and one who is, you know, working would probably David, who's always voting Democrat, to Brittany, who was voting Democrat, but then, you know, working for the Trump campaign, to Carol inside Brexit. We thought that making a film that was about these issues, having intimate access to people that were on very different sides of these issues, was important.
I love her as a character, I have to say, because I did not know how I felt about her. I'm not sure I know how I feel about her now, because there are moments I thought, oh, she's absolutely being ethical and she's turning a corner. And then there were other times when I thought, no, she's kind of in it for the travel and the exotic locations and the influence, you know, connecting with people. And so she was a deeply conflicted character for me. And I think that's what makes her really great. I wanted to come back to one of these moments that you were referring to earlier, and it's an important question in the film, and that is whether all of this data to try and persuade people, whether it actually, as you mentioned, Jahan, before, whether it takes away their free will and their autonomy, and whether this undermines democracy. That's an important point. So there's this interesting exchange in the film that you captured between Brittany and Paul Hilder. He's another character in the film, where he asks her about this.
And the idea of a company conducting large-scale analysis of a population and then identifying the triggers that people have in terms of what's going to move them from one state to another state, that feels very challenging to the individual's sense of autonomy and freedom and to the idea of democracy, doesn't it?
I don't know. I would challenge that. What this strategy is mostly meant to do is to identify people
who are still considering many different options.
Yes.
And educate them on some of the options that are out there. And if they're on the fence, then they can be persuaded to go one way or the other.
Yes.
Again, that is their own choice. But a lot of times these are individuals.
Is that their own choice?
In the end, they're the ones that go to the ballot box and make their decision.
Yeah. I mean, I'm asking you these questions as Brittany Kaiser.
I know.
Right? I'm not asking you these questions as Cambridge Analytica or SEL, because that's not who you are anymore. Right?
I get it.
And do you think Cambridge Analytica was ever involved in the contravention of people's human rights?
No. But, again, I start to question a lot of things the more I hear.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? Because, I mean, that is a big question, whether or not this data is so particular and so sophisticated that we're all, and not just credulous, ignorant people, but all of us, everyone, can be manipulated with propaganda.
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, you know, the idea that the persuadables are these unique people who are ignorant and easily influenced by what they hear and see, and that they're somehow alien to all of us, is in my opinion completely absurd. I mean, if that were true and none of us were persuadable, advertising wouldn't exist. Propaganda would have never worked. So we are much more vulnerable and persuadable than we think we are. Now, does that mean that all of us are persuadable politically on all issues? No, but that's not the point. The point is that if I am tracking you, if I am collecting your credit card swipes and your GPS locations and your what you like and don't like, and I'm having this incredible access to all of your expressions and the footprints that they leave behind, I'm able to understand you in a way that some would argue is better than yourself, because I have a 360 view of everything you're doing and I'm able to connect the dots. And that's what the algorithm is able to do. And that is the reality of the new economy that we live in. So much of it is built upon that relationship.
Yeah.
You know, and when we look at the valuation of the most powerful companies in America today, you look at Facebook, you look at Google, you look at Amazon, you look at these companies, you realize like obviously they must be doing something right if they continue to be valued at such levels. I mean, you look at Facebook and the fact that with everything that's happened this year, the company's still doing incredibly well. So I think there's no doubt that this works. I think the question is, what happens when it's applied to our democratic process?
Right.
And if our everyday expressions are trackable is our data, which is essentially what data is, right? Data is essentially recordable human behavior, right? So if our data is a commodity, as we clearly see in the film and as we clearly kind of begin to understand now, is everything up for sale? Mm-hmm. Is the entire democratic process in America commoditized? And is that okay? Is that something that we are comfortable with? And is that something that should be about whether you're a Democrat or Republican, or is that something that should fall into the lane of this is about the fundamental functionability of the democratic process? As Carol Caldweller says at the end of the film, this isn't about Brexit, you know, it's about leave or remain or Trump or Hillary. This is about whether we can have a free and fair election ever again. And I think it's really important to us to focus on that, whether we can have a free and fair election ever again. Mm. Whose balance sheet does that come up on, right?
Yeah.
And how do we hold the process accountable to that is something that I think the film is trying to, bring the attention towards.
There's a really shocking story or moment in the film. I'm not sure how much you want to give away, but Carol Cadwalder talks about this in the film, how Cambridge Analytica or at least their parent company were doing these experiments in other countries, and Brittany actually has a recorded sales presentation of Alexander Nix where he talks about how they manipulated voters in this election in Trinidad and Tobago. And this is really dark. Basically, what they tried to do by learning about different behaviors of voters is they figured out how they could try and increase apathy. And they came up with this campaign where young people would be proud to actually not vote. And it played a role in the election. Say something about that if you could.
So the Trinidad and Tobago story is a great one, and we, you know, focused on it because what it brought to our attention and why we used it is you have a clear example of Cambridge Analytica admitting to these PSYOP level campaigns and activities, and by PSYOP I mean psychological operations, which is a, you know, division. It's a classification of information warfare, and they conducted this in Trinidad and Tobago, and they developed this fantastically successful campaign called the Do So campaign, mm-hmm. Which they bragged about and talked about. And it was targeted towards the youth, and it was really well researched, really well executed, and it led to their candidate winning. But the key thing about that campaign is that it in an election was that it was a voter suppression campaign. So it was and Cambridge here, you have Alexander Nix openly talking, you know, and bragging about how successful they were at suppressing youth voter turnout by creating a propaganda campaign that made it cool to not vote. This is the same company that was operating in the United States, and many companies like it continue to operate today. And so I think it comes back to the same question we've been asking, which is, are these the new norms in America, where voter suppression is now something that we're excited about and we brag about and we, you know, advertise our incredible skills at conducting? Is that how a democracy is supposed to function? And if so, and if that's happening, especially when it's happening under the you know, the execution of companies that have been military contractors for years and have perfected and harnessed these skills on the dime of the American taxpayer and the British taxpayer in countries around the world, working with with military endeavors in the Middle East and other places. So, are we subsidizing voter suppression operations in third world countries and then having the privatized versions of those companies coming back to the UK and the US to be involved in the multi-billion-dollar election market? How does this kind of just – is this okay, and are we comfortable with that?
Yeah. Carol Cadwalder, she manages in her reporting – and again, she's an important player in the story, really crucial figure, of course – she starts to track down these former Cambridge Analytica employees, and this leads her to a man named Chris Wiley. He's an important part of the film as well. He used to work with Cambridge Analytica. He's become a whistleblower, really. And Wiley tells you something really interesting in the film, that Steve Bannon, and I think most listeners know who Steve Bannon is at this point, and people like him, looked at data and saw Cambridge Analytica as this weapon in the culture war.
Steve Bannon was the editor of Breitbart. He follows this idea of the Breitbart doctrine, which is that if you want to fundamentally change society, you first have to break it. And it's only when you break it is when you can remold the pieces into your vision of a new society. This was the weapon that Steve Bannon wanted to build to fight his culture war. And we could build them for him.
Do you think it's still used as a weapon? Has anything changed since Cambridge Analytica was forced to shut down, close? Or is that still, are still people still using information as weapons?
Oh, I would point you to another part of the film, actually, where Wheatland, who we film with, who was Julian Wheatland, right. Who was, what was his position, Kareem, in Cambridge Analytica?
He was the former chief operating officer.
Yes, the chief operating officer. Yeah. So he talks about how this is really just the beginning.
I mean, this is not about one company. This technology is going on unabated and will continue to go on. But Cambridge Analytica's gone. In some senses, I feel that that because of the way that this technology is moving so fast, and because people don't really understand it, and because there's a lot of concerns about it, there was always going to be a Cambridge Analytica. It just sucks for me. It was Cambridge Analytica.
As we take the film around and talk with experts in the area, in the technology fields and technology areas, we are hearing more and more that campaigns are using these technologies, and you know, and we actually had an interesting screening where a number of people attended, and a number of very prominent people in politics attended. Senator Warner, Kerry, John Kerry, and they finished watching the film and said, you know, if you don't, anybody running a political campaign right now should be watching this film to at least understand this world. Because without understanding it, you don't know the world that you're playing in.
I want to play a moment from Alexander Nix in the film. He didn't agree to talk to you, but you have a moment here where he's talking with the parliament. He's speaking before this hearing of this committee in the UK and in parliament. And Cambridge Analytica, the film is really even-handed about this. Cambridge Analytica starts to push back, saying it's not fair to portray them as one spokesman said, a Bond villain. They said they're not a Bond villain. And it does raise the question of whether or not the same thing would have happened to Cambridge Analytica or any other company if Trump had lost, or if Brexit, the Leave campaign, had failed. And so in this moment in the film, Nix he's confronted by one of the members of parliament who says, you're not really a victim, even though he's portraying himself as a victim. And his response is pretty powerful, and it raises this question of whether, in fact, he isn't a victim.
What happens if I was the victim? What happens if, as some of these investigations are concluded, people realize that actually we were simply the guys who were perceived to have contributed to the Trump campaign and were wrongly accredited with being the architects of Brexit, and as a result of the polarizing nature of those two political campaigns, the global liberal media took umbrage and decided to put us in their crosshairs and launch a coordinated attack on us as a company in order to destroy our reputations and our business. And all of this was underpinned by a stream of allegations, unfounded, groundless allegations that came from Mr. Wiley, who gave the media the ammunition that they needed, that they wanted to be able to attack us for something that, in the case of Brexit, we simply didn't do.
You are the victim in all of this.
Well, if you're sitting where I am right now, you probably feel quite victimized.
What do you make of that? His response to that, that this is, as he put it, a global liberal media effort, and that maybe if they had not been conservatives, people wouldn't have paid as much attention. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think there. Look, I think, are there elements of truth in what he's saying? I think there are. I think that when you look at Brexit and Trump's victories, you know, and the results of that referendum, those are two of the most unexpected events in recent modern political history. Right. So there has been a how the hell could this have happened feeling among a lot of circles in the liberal media. I think there's been a lot of people who've been clamoring for a silver bullet to fix it. And the reality is it's a lot messier than that. And the reality is, from our investigations into these stories and all these different nooks and crannies, there is no one reason why either of those two things happened. But what we do know is that the systems that enabled for those victories to happen, as they apply to the way in which our political advertising works and the way in which technology is interacting with the democratic process is, you know, the systems and the relationships between democracy and technology is one in which we've entered into a territory that is uncharted. Mm. We simply have never been in a frontier like this before. And while the result of the election may not have been in favor of what people in the liberal progressive circles wanted, the effects of this have nothing to do with liberalism or conservatism. The effects of this has led us to see that that information has been weaponized, and the weaponization of information is something that in my opinion really dismantles the foundation of the democratic process. Mm. So I think that is something that we have to look back on. And I think to support Nick's in a certain degree, I'd say what I think the question we should be asking ourselves is, how are we complicit in this system? Because this system didn't you know, its execution during Brexit and Trump is what brought it to our attention. But if you remove if you overturn those two political results, the effects of this new paradigm that we've entered into don't go away. Yeah, so we need to solve for this. And I think that is a point that Alexander is making. I mean, there was a certain hysteria around Cambridge Analytica, where Cambridge became blamed for everything that happened all over the world. And I think that there was a hysteria around that was kind of overly exaggerated to a certain degree. That doesn't negate, though, the fact that Cambridge conducted some, you know, very ethically questionable campaigns. The problem is, though, is most of the things Cambridge did were not against the law, because we don't actually have the laws in place to safeguard us against these realities. So from where he's sitting, why is he getting a bad rap for being a successful entrepreneur, pursuing the quote-unquote American dream of, you know, of becoming a, you know, Cambridge is on its path to being a billion-dollar company. Like, that's what they were pursuing, right? Is it Cambridge Analytica's fault that the American democratic process is the largest market for elections in the world? Is it Cambridge Analytica's fault that, you know, that every election cycle, you know, breaks the record of the amount of billions of dollars spent? Yeah. It's not. So we've allowed for this to become a marketplace. Why are we upset now when we're waking up to the reality that our politics are for sale?
It brings us to one final quote here I want to play from the film. And it gets us back to something you were mentioning, Kareem, earlier, that, you know, people having this idea that all of this data manipulation is really only affecting, you know, the uneducated or the credulous. But it's one of the points the film makes is that, this is David Carroll again, that everyone, as he puts it here, is susceptible.
People don't want to admit that propaganda works, because to admit it means confronting our own susceptibilities, horrific lack of privacy, and hopeless dependency on tech platforms, ruining our democracies on various attack surfaces. Join the struggle to help get our data back.
And of course, that's part of his campaign, is to get our data back. Let me ask you this finally, both of you. This is something that Carol raises in the question, in a powerful TED Talk, which some portions of which you include in the film. She asks this really important question of all of us, and that is, will we, now that we're learning all of this, will we, and this is how she puts it, will we just sit back and play with our phones as this darkness falls? And as you've been working on this film and as you've been exploring all of this, where have you come down, if you have yet? Where will we end up? Will we just sort of fiddle with our phones while all of this comes about?
Well, I haven't given up my Facebook account, which, you know, I question all the time. I must say I'm posting a lot less, but I am posting about this film, which I see the irony of.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like we shouldn't have to choose between this connectivity and the sort of, you know, and all of this taking of our data without our knowledge. It feels like there should be, we should be able to move to a place where there is a little bit more transparency.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we're not calling for a kind of a Luddite revolution where we abandon technology and say damn with the technologists and shame on them and we don't want to have technology. That's not what we're saying at all. I think that's a false choice, as Jahan was saying. What we're saying is perhaps we deserve better. Perhaps we deserve a world in which the most brilliant minds in Silicon Valley are incentivized by certain guardrails that we put up as a society to protect ourselves. Just like the same way we had, seatbelts to help us understand the wreckage that the automobile industry could create. We need guardrails for technology because we're seeing wreckage sites. And I think it's just a moment that we have to kind of, lean into, because we were conditioned for so often to just believe that technology, as Google used to have their kind of tagline be, could do no evil, and that technology was just always going to do good, and that was it. But now that we're seeing kind of a different iteration of the effects of technology, we have to ask ourselves how accountability is going to happen and where it's going to come from and what we're going to do about it. And I think that this coming election is important. But I think that beyond elections, we have to look at this interaction technology that we have on a daily basis that has nothing to do with the political cycle. And we have to think about whether we want this technology to serve us or whether we want to be servants to this technology.
That's Karim Amer and Jahan Nojaim, who co-directed the documentary film The Great Hack, which you can come see on Wednesday night, that's July 10th, at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. We're going to be showing this as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Karim and Jahan will join us via Skype for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. Oh, and I should mention, we're also looking for your feedback. We have a survey that we'd love to have you take if you have the time. We're asking about the stuff that you like and the critical stuff about the show as well. You can find a link to that survey also in the description for this show. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.